My sister's married to Bruce into the Rivers family, and Mr. Bruce Rivers is an elder in Elkhart now. And he had heard I went to Turkey, and he thought it'd be nice to be able to share with a brother in there, because now everybody gets the opportunity to travel, and he thought it'd be nice to share with the congregations there the what happened on the Turkey trip and try to share what we learned. So I put together a presentation for that. I'll be doing that in several weeks in Elkhart, and several weeks from now I'll be doing that in Elkhart. But I thought I'd share that with you today as well. It's set up to go for about an hour, over an hour, but I will try to get done in less time than that. But I think the goal would be to try to share with you the experience that we had for those who went to Turkey. Again, we went and visited each of the seven churches of Revelation. And it does bring to light, you know, you're seeing those things in person. You get more out of the Bible, and you have some very interesting things. So I'm going to try to share that with you. I have some pictures there, photographs, some lessons, some insights, and try to share that with you for the sermon today. See if my little my button here works. So what I'm going to do is just go over quickly how the tour was set up, a quick little overview of Turkey and Istanbul, and then go over the churches specifically. Now, we did not visit the churches in this order. We went in a different order, but I'm going to present this in the order that they're presented in Revelation. And this will give you a little bit of overview of historical background on each of those cities. Some of this we have heard in the Revelation series. And then I'll give you a little bit of a biblical overview and some photos or key takeaways from each site. Again, I have 44 slides here, and in 44 minutes I'll go as quick as I can. So some of this I won't go. Some of this you have to read on your own. But just a quick overview of the tour. We had about 120 attend. We started in Istanbul, and then we flew to Izmir. And then we had buses from there, which took us to different locations. We had three buses. Each bus had its own tour guide. And what was nice was each sermon that day was tailored around the site we were going to. Usually it was a tie-in between where we were going. There was a feast message. You know, there was a tie-in between the feast and where we were going. So it was a nice tie-in. Church started usually at 8 a.m. or 8:30, so we could see things in the afternoon. So it was not as bad as it sounds, but it was definitely an early morning for church. And many people, may have concerns about doing a traveling feast like this. I definitely have some concerns. But for those who have been on a feast, we actually travel from different sites throughout the feast. You actually, one positive is that you get to actually visit more with people. You're traveling. It's a very bonding experience when you get on a plane together and fly somewhere, and we're all going together, and you get on buses, and you actually spend more time, more fellowship, I believe. And you also have these little study books, so we're studying about the sites. So I thought, it didn't take the traveling feast site did not take away from the feast by any means, and actually maybe enhanced it. It was a well-organized tour. It was very well done. Quality of the tour was really done. They went and got very nice, very established tour guides, and they tailored around us, and they did a good job. And we had, I believe, outstanding cooperation and unity. The attitudes were good, and safety. So I believe this was all evidence that we had God's spirit and protection there. So it went very well, very smoothly, and no issues. So let me just give you a little bit of overview of Turkey. You may be aware of the name Turkey, the country Turkey, but not actually that familiar where it came from. It actually has a population of about 72 million people. Its capital is Ankara, and its largest city is Istanbul, about twice the size of California. It was founded in 1923 when the Ottoman Empire dissolved. And it was the father, their George Washington, you might say, is a person named Mustafa Kemal. And he later took on a surname of Atatürk, which means the father of the Turks. And he was a very forward-thinking person. He actually made it more of a secular country versus a religious country. That's him right there. He's wearing a Western suit. He was very forward-thinking and thinking and tried to put in practices or programs that would modernize the country. It was a republic. He made a democracy of Turkey, which is why it's one of the few Muslim countries that probably have a relatively peaceful environment. It's similar to like the UK parliament system, where they have a parliament, and from the parliament parties, they choose who the prime minister will be. Turkey for a long time has been a good ally of the U.S. It's joined NATO in 1952. And in 1947, the Truman Doctrine said we'd always guarantee its security. It's actually a very strategic country and where it's placed, which I'll show you in a minute. And currently there's a bid by Turkey to be part of the EU. Now that hasn't fully occurred. There's some issues with that, which I won't go into, but they're trying to join the EU. And Turkey, again, is why it's important. It's really where Europe and Asia meet, or East and West meet. And it's got 98%, it's a Muslim country, but it's very secular. If you went there, people are always asking, you know, is it going to be safe there? How would you feel about going there during this time period? And actually, it's a very secular country. People walking about on the street, dressed very Western, very modern. And so you don't feel necessarily like you're in a country like Saudi Arabia. It also borders 8 other countries. Some of them are friendly to Turkey, some of them not so friendly. Countries like Syria, and then there's countries like Greece, Iran, parts of Russia. So it's got an interesting border. Just to kind of show you how it looks, where it is at the top right hand here, you see where Turkey is situated in comparison to Europe. Again, I'll show you where we flew into Istanbul, and then we flew into Izmir. Izmir, which you'll see later on, is actually Smyrna. If you know Smyrna and Izmir, it's got a similar name there. They actually call it Izmir now. It's actually the same Smyrna that we will see in a moment. Istanbul is strategically located. It's, as you see, there's a satellite map. One half of it's in Europe, one half is in Asia. And it's the only city that I know of, it's the only city that is actually in two continents. And at different times in history, it was the capital of different empires. It was the capital of the Roman Empire. Constantine established that when he was the emperor in 330. And there's two halves of the empire. And when the Rome fell, it became the Byzantine Empire, and that's, or the East Roman Empire, and that was the Roman Empire for almost another 1,000 years. And then the Ottoman Empire made it its capital when it conquered the East Roman Empire. Now, Istanbul was founded by the Greek colonists in 670 BC. And again, as I noticed, it's a very strategic location. It's not only two continents on either side of it. It's also got land trade, water trade, and it's very important from a cultural perspective and also architecturally and religiously. You know, it's got, where the two religions kind of met. Want to move in quickly here. If you went to Istanbul, one of the things you'd want to see, for the primary thing you want to see, is St. Sophia or the Hagia Sophia Church, the Church of the Holy Wisdom. It was rebuilt by Justinian in 532 AD, and it was modeled after the Roman Pantheon. And it's interesting because it's the second largest dome church in the world, and it's got 4 acres of gold mosaics. It's made of fine materials, ivory, marble, and precious materials. When the Ottoman Empire took it over in 453, Sultan Mohammed II immediately made it into a mosque, and he did that by adding some minarets around there and changed some of the inside. So now it's a museum. In 1935, it turned into a museum. So just to give you, that's how it looks, a few pictures of it. As you can see, the minarets around it that makes it, and which they added to it to make it a mosque. They also, you still see some of the mosaics, though they're now uncovered. And you see these pictures of Mary holding Jesus. And as we'll see later on, worshiping of goddesses was very important during this time period. So it's not a surprise that they focus on Mary, and there's Jesus as a little baby, and then you have, in one picture, you have a king or with a pouch of money, which I guess tries to imply that if you're done, you should bring money to the church. So, another site you'd want to potentially visit in Istanbul is the Blue Mosque. The Blue Mosque was created or built by the Sultan Ahmed, and he built it deliberately next to the Hagia Sophia, what we just saw, and his goal was to make it a much larger mosque. However, they couldn't match the architecture and the size of the Hagia Sophia, so it was not as big as the Hagia Sophia, and that just shows the architecture that was available back during Justinian's time, and how impressive that dome is. They could not recreate it or match what was done there. Something interesting about Sultan Ahmed, he got in a little bit of trouble, though, because he put 6 minarets around the Blue Mosque. And that was a bit of a problem for him because the mosque in Mecca had 6 minarets. So he got out of that very cleverly by funding a 7th minaret in Mecca. So he didn't take one of his minarets down. He just bought for Mecca a 7th one. So Mecca would be always viewed as the primary mosque to the Muslim religion. So you can see a little bit of it. There's got a bit of a blue tint. That's why I call it the Blue Mosque. Now here's some general sites around here. I wanted to point out some important ones, like the one in the middle. That was, they do have Starbucks all around the world, including Turkey. On the left-hand side is a picture of just some general types of food you might see you're walking down the street. If you happen to be a protest of some sort, and we're there. Somebody said they were protesting America. I don't know, but they looked peaceful, but still demonstrating. There was about, a line of 400 people there, and they had flags, and so it was one of the parties there. On the right-hand side, just that's the top, is the view of outside our window when we were staying in Istanbul, so you could see all the trade. And on the bottom right-hand corner is the Bosphorus Bridge, which connects Asia and Europe. So. So I just want to cover a little bit the 7 churches of Revelation. Again, we cover this in the Bible study. Mr. Fay, I spent, I think, multiple sessions on this. I won't cover it all, but I did want to kind of go over a little bit of it. I want to show you how it fits on the map. Again, the best way to think of the 7 churches is it's like a horseshoe. It's a mail route. It starts in Ephesus, and it went around kind of like in a horseshoe shape. So you kind of connect the dots with Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira. You kind of go in a horseshoe. And again, it was an ancient mail route, and that's the mail route they run around. And again, something that Mr. Fay brought out, which I think is common knowledge, is just 3 views about the 7 churches, and that is that the message itself, which is found in Revelation 1:20 through 3:20, is that these were messages to the individual churches at that time. So if you're living in Ephesus, that would apply to you at that very time. It's also thought that the message could apply or has attitudes at all times. So all these attitudes of these churches or characteristics of the churches could be existing at all times. And it's also the common view, which I think most of us believe is true, is that it also represents church eras. So Ephesus was the first church era, and Laodicea would be the last church era. So let's go to Ephesus. Ephesus, in one way, is one of the most interesting, or the most material in Ephesus is there, because it's still one of the cities that's still pretty much intact, more than the other cities. Some of the other cities we'll see had cities grow up around it. You can't really see, like for example, Izmir or Smyrna. There's actually a real city there of several million people. So what's left of Smyrna is just a few little areas that have not been built up on or built around on. But Ephesus is one of the most impressive cities to see as far as what's still there. It's a major port city of the Aegean coast, so it's right in the port. It was founded by the Greeks in 1000 BC, and again, you'll see this same pattern again, where you had the local goddess of Sibyl. She was a local goddess that was worshipped, and then the Greeks came along and changed it to Artemis, and then the Romans came along and changed it to Diana. So they had this common thread of worshipping goddesses. The Temple of Artemis was built in 547 BC, and it was destroyed by fire in 356. The Ephesians, interestingly, turned down Alexander the Great to rebuild the temple. And at that time, when it was rebuilt, it was known as one of the 7 wonders of the world. So it was an impressive building. Ephesus was at its pinnacle in the 1st and 2nd century, and it had a population of about 225,000 people, which made it the 3rd or 4th largest city in the Roman Empire. And no one knows exactly how temple looked. So here's one artist's rendition of that. And now, 2 main reasons why it was a very important city was that it was Yeah, the temple. The temple drew a lot of visitors, a lot of tourists, a lot of people wanted to worship. And then because that visitors, the commerce built up around the temple, it served as a bank and then also served as employment. So it was like a big hub, employment hub. And then also Ephesus had a harbor. And the harbor was obviously used for trade and shipping and travel. And interestingly, both of those things are gone. Now the temple is now gone. There's very little there, which we'll see in a minute. And the harbor, if you go there today, is actually 3 miles away because of silt and other things. The harbor is not right on the banks of Ephesus anymore. It's actually 3 miles away from where it was initially. Just to kind of, again, capture what it says in Revelation about Ephesus, it's the only church in Revelation that's mentioned that we know for sure that Paul visited. He may have visited some of the other churches, but for sure we know he visited Ephesus. He went there on his second and third missionary journeys, and after his first visit, he left Priscilla and Aquila there, and that's found in Acts 18, and that's when Apollos, who became well known for his speaking and his dynamic speaking and a strong preacher of the word. He was from Alexandria and came into Ephesus at that time and got some special training from Priscilla and Aquila. On Paul's second visit, he was there, it says, for 3 years, and he started off preaching in a synagogue for 6 months, and then I think eventually left that, went to the school of Tyrannus, which was a school of rhetoric or philosophy. Also, what happened in Ephesus, which is interesting, is that where we learned of anointed cloths, and that's where if you get sick today and just know how to minister and you get anointed cloth, this is where that first occurred, where Paul and maybe others anointed the cloths, and then people were healed. There's also some things where that's interesting, which is some Jewish exorcists saw how successful Paul and maybe others were in using Christ's name to draw out demons and evil spirits. They tried to do the same thing, and it didn't work out very well for them. Actually, if you want to read the story, it's very interesting. It kind of backfired on them. But they had such an impact, Paul did, and those in that church, of turning people away from the occult and maybe worshiping, if you know, Diana and all those sort of mystical type things, that they burned $50,000 pieces of silver's worth of books. They burned books. So these are very valuable books. They burned them. They were so moved by what was going on there. And this is where we start hearing a story about Demetrius, the silversmith, getting a little upset. I mentioned around that temple, there was a trade going on. There's a lot of commercial. They were making trinkets. People were coming in to visit the temple. And now people are turning away from that and being called. So they were getting upset. They realized their livelihood was being potentially destroyed. So they caused a riot. And Alex will show you the theater in a minute. And they caused a big riot. And they rushed into the theater and started chanting, "Great is Diana," you know. And that's when they dragged some of the early Christian leaders in the church and into the theater and tried to create a commotion against the Christians. And I'll show you that theater in a minute. We also know that in Ephesus, Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, and he possibly wrote 2 Corinthians or part of 2 Corinthians. Now, turning to Revelation, where we read of the church, I just broke it down in the same pattern, positives, had many positives. Christ said that they did not tolerate those who are evil. He tested false apostles. They persevered. They had patience. They labored for the Lord. And they hated the Nicolaitans, which we don't know exactly who they were, but we did know they were false and troublesome men. The concerns about the Ephesians is they left their first love. So the warning is to them is that they need to repent and do the first works, or they had their lampstand removed. The reward for the Ephesians is that those who overcome will receive the tree of life. And one last tradition is that John moved to Ephesus. And we know he wrote the book of Revelation, or he was given the revelation to write in Patmos. And tradition says that he moved to Ephesus after that. So to give you some photos of that, this is, again, the most impressive thing. The center of Ephesus at that time was the temple of Diana or Artemis. It was about 377 feet long, 180 feet wide, and it had 127 Ionic-style columns and about 60 feet high. It was made of marble, gold, and silver, and it had famous paintings and sculptures. As you can see, there's nothing much there now. What you see on the left-hand side is what people think it looked like, and the right is what's remaining. And I put a quote there at the bottom just to show you that many people came and saw this. And again, this is one of the seven wonders of the world, and they actually placing it maybe as one of the, out of the seven, the top wonder of the world, because it was so magnificent and so well built and so beautiful. But today there's nothing there. I mentioned the theater in which there was a big riot and they stormed out and started chanting Graves Diana. This is it. Again, this is what's left of it. It was much more impressive at the time, but it could fit 25,000 people. They could have plays there or theater or festivals. They had gladiator matches there occasionally. They had excellent acoustics. Apparently you could whisper and the person in the very back row could hear you, so you wouldn't need microphones, because they didn't have them back then either, but they had very good acoustics. There was a three-story stage facade, so that's not there today, but there's a three-story on the stage, a big three-story stage facade. There's a circular orchestra pit. Again, this is where they had their ride over Diana, so you could just imagine them all filling in here, getting very worked up, being very upset, and chanting Grace Diana, and then taking several hours for them to calm down and be quieted. There was also a very big library there. And this is the picture of the library. This it was built in 125 BC. It has an exaggerated facade, so it looks huge on the outside. The front of it is huge, but behind it was not the whole library. It was more of a for show, but there were some rooms behind it which held 12,000 scrolls at one point. And then they had statues all along there, and this statue, I believe, was representing the Statue of Wisdom. Therefore, Joanna is sitting there next to it, trying to get some wisdom from, I guess, the statue. I don't know. So, and you'll see this throughout the whole, every one of the cities. Rome, Roman Empire, and cities at that time were very sophisticated. I told somebody, other than not having electricity or having cars, they had many, many of the same things we have today. They had very advanced medical services. And again, when you see the symbol for medicine with the snake, we know where that came from. Actually, I'll show you a little later on where it came from specifically. They had public toilets, and then they had baths, warm and cold baths, and many, many other things, sewers and running water. So in many ways, it was not different from what we have today, just that it didn't have electricity and maybe cars and some of those modern things, but in many ways, it was very advanced and very sophisticated. So let's move on to Smyrna. Smyrna is the current-day Izmir, and that's where we flew into Izmir. The Greeks founded the city, and it's right in the harbor, so it's a very beautiful city. You go there today, it's a modern city. Very few of the ruins are still there because the modern city built up around it. You can go have, like we did, a nice drink on the harbor, you know, a meal on the water. By first century, it's a very advanced, it had very straight streets. It had a temple to the mother goddess. Again, we had the same idea of a woman goddess or the mother goddess or mother of fertility. It had a huge gymnasium, and it was one of the first cities in Asia Minor that declared loyalty to Rome. So it was also a major center of the imperial cult. Not only did they have goddesses, you know, you worshiped any god you want, and I've mentioned several of the goddesses, but you actually could have many, many gods in this time period. But one of the most important things you had to worship was the empire, or the imperial cult, or the emperor. And this was a major center of worshiping the emperor. It also had a very large Jewish community, and also we know it was the home of Polycarp. Polycarp was one of John's disciples. So when John died, Polycarp took over, and we know he was one of the ones that stood up for the truth. And when things started to change that time period, and some of the influences of Rome started influencing the church, we knew Polycarp stood up for that, and his home was Smyrna. Just the overview of Smyrna from the biblical perspective, what it says in Revelation, the positives are that Christ said, "I know your tribulations and poverty, but you are rich." So even though they had tribulations and poverty and a lot of persecutions, they were rich. I know those who are of the synagogue of Satan. Again, this could be referencing the fact that they had actual worshiping of the emperor. And I don't think many people would deny that, you know, Satan's influence was probably very heavy in or behind the Roman Empire. Concerns, this is one of the churches that has no concerns or issues with it. It had no issues. The other one being Philadelphia. So they have, and only warning is, do not fear those things which you're about to suffer. So they were going to suffer some trials, and the reward is be faithful until death, and you receive the crown of life. And he who overcomes shall not be hurt by second death. So these are the rewards of people in Smyrna. It's not a lot of, again, there's not a lot to see in Smyrna. Again, there's a very modern city all built around. So when cities stayed in place, what happened was the ruins kind of got built over. So there's not much today, but there is a little bit of an agora. An agora is a marketplace in Roman times, and this is what's left. And of the left is the agora, basically. And so you can see this would be the marketplace where it sells different things. And if you wanted to buy something, that's where you'd go. All right, moving on. Next to Ephesus, the other probably most impressive place to visit was Pergamos. It's 65 miles north of Ephesus. It was high up on a hill, so we had to take a bus ride up the hill, and it's kind of a steep ride. It was founded by the Greeks, and during its height, it had about 150,000 people living there, and had an even more impressive library than Ephesus. They actually had a library of about 200,000 scrolls. However, when you're part of the Roman Empire, emperors can do what they want. So one of the emperors decided to give Cleopatra all these scrolls in Alexandria. So Alexandria was known for having a big library, and it got bigger when they got 200,000 scrolls. So, and later on, unfortunately, we know Alexandria burned or destroyed. For some reason, we don't know exactly what happened there, but the library that was in Alexandria was destroyed. So anything that was in this library is now gone, which historians are sad about, but that's what happened. The word parchment, which I think we all know about, parchment actually comes from the same word as Pergamos. So Pergamos, you might say, invented parchment, and that they're one of the first ones to start using parchment. And the word parchment and Pergamos is the same, coming from the same word, to reflect that. It was a leading cultural center. Had a medical center. Again, one of the gods they worshipped was Asclepius, and he used the origin. We saw that medical symbol we saw before with the snake. He used the one that apparently created that symbol to reflect medical services. And that thought is that initially he used snakes. Somehow he used snakes in his medical practice, and they worshipped again this person who was God. Later on, it got to be more advanced, where they used real medical practices. One of the most famous people that came from this area was a person named Galen, who really progressed modern medicine. He wrote many books, many things about how the body worked. He dissected a lot of animals to understand how the blood system worked. So he had heavy influences on the world of the medicine and for many, many centuries. Again, it's a religious center. There's a temple to Zeus and many, many other people that they all worship. Again, what's really interesting was that they were a leader in imperial worship or imperial cult worship. They had a temple to Augustus, a temple to Trajan, and also a temple to Hadrian. Well, this was very unusual. They had three temples to three different emperors, because you had to bid to have a temple, because if you had a temple, it meant money came in. So they were granted three different times they were awarded three different times to have this temple. So it was very unusual to have one, much less two, much less three. So it was a very prestigious award given to Pergamos to have these three different temples there. So again, they had an abundance of temples to false gods, pagan gods, and possibly that's why there's a reference in Revelation calling it the Satan's throne. Pergamos in Revelation has some positives. It says, I know your works, and you dwell where Satan's throne is. So again, this may be a reference to all those too many temples and the center of, in that area, of worshiping the emperor of Rome. It says, hold fast to my name, and you held fast to my name. You did not deny my faith. And it also mentions a person, Antipas, as a faithful martyr. Some of the concerns with Pergamos, though, is those who hold on to the doctrine of Balaam, and they also ate things sacrificed to idols, and they committed sexual immorality. This could be physical or maybe allusion to the fact that they kind of mixed their religious beliefs in with the local religious beliefs, and they some of them held on to the doctrine of the Nicolaitans. The warning is simple: repent or else. It's kind of a simple one, maybe one we all should, an easy one to remember, repent or else. But the reward is, he who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna to eat, and I will give him a white stone with a new name. Some of the photographs of Pergamos, again, it's high up on a hill. The water you see in the background is man-made lake that was not there back in the days of Paul and the apostles in the early church. So that's not there, but it's very up high on a hill. You can see a large theater there. You see some of the temples that are still there. And this was really, I thought, it kind of matched Ephesus in many ways as far as what you could see and the grandeur is still there. Here's, again, we mentioned Asclepion. He, again, was the god of healing. And because of this, they actually had the world's first hospital there. That's what's left of it. And on the right, we mentioned the cult worship of the emperors. Here's the temple of Trajan. Trajan was one of the emperors. Again, this could be very well a reference to the throne of Satan when it's mentioned in Revelation. Again, a picture of the theater. Some of these theaters could hold 25,000, 40,000 people. Huge. Another picture of the Temple of Trajan. I guess Joanne and I weren't too worried about it, and we were hanging out there anyway. But much of this temple today is actually in Berlin Museum, so much of what was there, what was uncovered, has been moved to the Berlin Museum. Next, we move to Thyatira, and just to kind of realize how close things are to each other, it's 50 miles north of Izmir or Smyrna along the path. It's 30 miles inland from the coast. Again, it was another wealthy town in the Roman times. It was a crossroad or major route, so there's sort of routes that would go to on the Rome or Pergamos, and this it was on the crossroad of those routes, so it became an important city. It was known for trade guilds, so all sorts of different trades would be housed there, and they would have trade guilds. One of the ones is the production of purple dye, and we actually have someone mentioned in the Bible in Acts, Lydia of Thyatira, and she sold dyes to Philippi, and these were purple dyes. They also were known for pagan feasts, and we don't know for sure, but some people think Paul may have been here. We don't have anything documented, but some people believe that he may have preached there while he was living in Ephesus, so he could have easily, you know, been based in Ephesus and taken a short trip over to Thyatira. Revelation mentions that Thyatira has some strong positives. It says, like God knows, or Christ knows your works, which are love, service, faith, and patience. And says the last works are more than the first, so they ended up stronger than they were when they began. Concerns or issues with Thyatira were that they actually allowed Jezebel to teach and seduce my servants, and to commit sexual immorality, eat things sacrificed to idols. And Revelation says, you know, Christ will cast her into a sick bed, and those who commit adultery with her will have a great tribulation and will kill her children. Warnings are repent and hold fast to what you have until I come. And the reward is, he who overcomes and keeps my works until the end, I will give power over the nations and will give him the morning star. And we believe the morning star references Christ. So they will get Christ as part of the reward. Some pictures of Thyatira. Oops. Yeah, again, this is a modern day city, so there's not a lot of ruins still there. As you can see in the background, some modern apartments. So this is what's left of Thyatira. In the middle, you see people from Chicago that went to Thyatira. And again, there wasn't a whole lot there. I think we walked in and were gone about 25 minutes. So this is pretty much the gist of what's still there. Not very much. Sardis. Sardis is 60 miles east of Izmir or Smyrna. And it's, again, on a hill or a mountain. It's also got a river at the bottom, which served as a moat. People, which made it very hard to attack and made it almost impregnable. So one of the warnings to start is to that they had a failure to watch. And maybe that's because they were so confident in their surroundings that they didn't have to watch for their enemies, which actually a couple times turned out to be something that caused them to be taken over or captured. It was the ancient capital of the Lydian kingdom at one point. This is where the first coins back in 600 BC came from. Before then, they weren't using coins. And this is because they had a river rich in gold, and they started making coins to use in money. Romans entered Sardis in about 133 BC. It has a very large Jewish community, one of the largest synagogues outside of Palestine or modern-day Israel. And again, you'll see the worship of Artemis and Cybele, also very prominent. And again, it fell, it was captured by the Ottoman Empire in 1396. Christ said of Sardis, "As I know your works, you have a name that you're alive." Basically saying, because you have a name, it's the only reason why you're still, you know, you're alive. Some issues, but you're dead. I have not found your works perfect before God. Warnings, again, be watchful. And this could be an allusion to the fact that they were very confident in their surroundings, and they thought they no one could really take them, attack them, because of where they were situated on a hill and with a river as a moat. But it says, be watchful and strengthen the things which remain. Remember how you have received and heard. Hold fast and repent. And if you will not watch, I will come to you as a thief. So that reference is probably what really did happen to them, and also a future of Christ coming very suddenly if you're not watching. Reward, there's a few names in Sardis who have not defiled my garments, and they will walk with me in white, for they are worthy. He who overcomes shall be clothed in white garments, and I will not blot out his name from the book of life, and I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. So here's some pictures or photographs from Sardis. Again, it had a huge gymnasium, 5.5 acres. This is us walking into that, the front of the gymnasium, and it was in the heart of the city. And again, they had very, very modern conveniences, just like I've mentioned. They had the tepidaria, which is the warm bath, the caldarium, which is the hot bath, and then they had a frigidarium, which was the cold bath, and they often, like people do today, they finish with a massage. What's interesting is that they had a very large synagogue, which means they had a large Jewish community. It was in the heart of the city, and what may be of interest is actually it was an integral part of the gymnasium, so it was kind of connected to the gymnasium. It had about a 1,000-person capacity in synagogue. And what's interesting, which maybe kind of shows you maybe how the blending of religions occurs in all areas, they actually found in the synagogue some ancient sculptures that came from the goddess of Cybele or that temple, and it was sculptures of lions and things like that. So these kind of found their way in, these found their way into the synagogue. And maybe they were, you know, made people feel better by saying this, you know, this is the lion of Judah or whatever. But whatever the case is, these actually came from a pagan temple and made into a synagogue. So it shows that when you're close next, when you're next to each other and you're mixing a lot, it's very hard to stay separated from each other's religions. And if it's a pagan religion, in this case, you're going to start blending together some of the things. There's a lot of shops. They had a big long street, which is called the Colonnaded Street. They had two-story structures, and they just had row after row of these little shops. Here's one, what's left of one shop. And you can't see it, but there's a little plaque there. And on there it says, this is a restaurant. And they know by what some inscriptions that were left there that this was owned by a man named Jacob, and he actually was a Christian. And along the street, there was a whole host of Christian booths or shops, and there's a whole host of Jewish shops. So again, the Jewish and Christian community mixed. The Romans viewed them as the same in many ways, but the Jewish cultures and the Christian cultures were very similar, but starting to be distinct at that point in time. In Sardis is also, again, another temple to Artemis or Diana. At this point, they had the fourth largest Ionic temple. Now, Ionic, I didn't know what that was, so I thought I would, you know, help. If you don't know what it is either, what is it? If you see on the right-hand side, Joanne and I climbed up these things here, up these columns. And if you see at the bottom here, there's these little decorations on the column. That's an Ionic column. A Doric is a little more boring, more flat, and not so interesting. And a Corinthian is even more, got more, a different style and more carvings into it. So we actually didn't climb up there. That's just a, no one laughed. But that was actually, but this is the Artemis Temple. It was a very large temple, seventh largest Greek temple at the time. Again, it's a blending of Cybele, who was the original goddess, Artemis, and the Diana. They're all very common. Artemis was actually the goddess of the hunt. And again, it's about the size of a football field in size. Moving on to Philadelphia. Again, this was 30 miles southeast of Sardis. So we're kind of going, you know, if you think of that horseshoe shape, we're going down the horseshoe side on the right-hand side. It's about 105 miles from Smyrna. It was established in 189 B.C. King Eumenes of Pergamon, remember we talked about Pergamus, he named it out of love for his brother, Attalus II. It has, unfortunately, frequent earthquakes, and it was, it was an important pass through mountains between Hermus and the Meander rivers, river valleys, and all east trade, so all trade going to Rome went through this city. One thing that I kind of liked about Philadelphia was it didn't just have, you know, a goddess of Artemis or some goddess. Actually, they worshipped the god of wine or of the vine because they were a strong producer of wine. So that's who they worshipped, Bacchus, the god of the vine, or because they were strong, a very fertile area, and they could produce wine. When Polycarp of Smyrna was martyred, Christians in Philadelphia were martyred at the same time, so they were all kind of lumped together. In 1490, Turks captured the city, and currently, it's fourth of the city is populated with Greeks. So again, Turks and Greeks are different background, and currently aren't even, from a nation perspective, are not friendly to each other over Cyprus. But this city actually has fourth of it as Greek. One of the interesting things that they told us in the tour guide told us, is that Turkey has more Roman ruins than Italy, and it has more Greek ruins than Greece. So that's something interesting, and that's so it's more, people don't really think of it that way, but it's actually more ruins in Turkey than Italy or Greece. I think we all know a little bit about Philadelphia. Everybody wants to be Philadelphia. Because it has all positives and nothing bad about it. It says, I know your works. I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it. You have little strength, and have kept my word and not denied it. Deny my name. There's no concerns or issues given to Philadelphia, no warnings. And then the rewards are because those who are the synagogue of Satan worship before your feet. So people that do worship, and part of the synagogue of Satan will be worshiping before these people's feet, to know, and it'll keep, and God will keep you from the hour of trial. He who overcomes will be made a pillar in the temple of my God, and I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, and on him a new name. So again, everybody wants to be Philadelphia because it's got some nice things about it. But unfortunately, there's not much there to see today. There's only basically this. There's only three pillars standing. Again, this is in a modern city, so much of the ruins have been covered over, or built on top of. There's three pillars right now. Again, this is one of the places we walked right into, and about 10 minutes later we're gone because there's really not a lot to see. There's three pillars. This is one of a church of St. John the theologian, and it's a Byzantine-style church. So it's not much there anymore. Laodicea was named after Laodike. She was the wife of Antiochus II in 261 B.C. This city was populated by Syrians and Jews that were transplanted from Babylonia. So that's where they came from. This city had little consequence until the Roman province was formed in 190 B.C. and became a great center of wealth. And it had a lot of industry. And in fact, it says that out of all the cities, even more than Ephesus, for whatever reason, this was even a wealthier city. And that's because it had a lot of industry. It was famous for some fine black wool that came from that area and some Phrygian powder, which was black, which they used as like a makeup type item around the eyes. It also had a very strong banking center. We know some very famous Romans would actually put letters of credit there in the banks. And in AD 60, an earthquake destroyed the city. But later, the city refused help from Rome. Rome actually said, we'll help rebuild your city. And they said, well, we're so rich or so self-supporting, self-sufficient, we don't need your help. And we'll see the attitude in the in Revelation. It brings that attitude up. Colossae and Hierapolis, which we did visit those two sites, they're really nearby. Colossae has cold water. Hierapolis has hot water. They actually had springs, which we took hot baths in Hierapolis. They had very hot springs. You get, you know, they had medical benefits, apparently. Laodicea actually was destroyed by an earthquake and never recovered. We actually met in a room while we were there. It wasn't in Laodicea, but it was actually near Hierapolis. But we actually met in a conference room called the Laodicea's room. So I guess for that day, we were all Laodiceans. No one could deny it. We were all there. Unfortunately, the Laodicea church has no positives. That's why nobody wants to be Laodicea, you know, or called the Laodicean. I guess people don't take it, you know, we like calling other people Laodiceans, but it's nobody wants to be a Laodicean themselves because there's no positives. There's some strong concerns, either hot or cold. Christ says, I will vomit you out of my mouth. You say I'm rich. Again, this could be a reference to being like they're very wealthy. They had banking there. You say you're wealthy, you need nothing, but you're actually wretched, miserable, poor, blind, or naked. The warning is, counsel, so you may buy of me gold refined in the fire that you may be rich, and white garments that you may be clothed, and anoint your eyes with eye salve that you may see, and be zealous and repent. And if you do are zealous and repent, and you're Laodicean, then you overcome, and God will allow you to sit, or give you, grant you to sit with him on his throne. So again, there's a few pictures here of Laodicea. Again, talks about the water. We actually took pictures of the water pipes. There's two pictures of water pipes here, and these are water pipes. They brought the water in from several miles away, and it was a calcium-rich water, so it would get hardened. Again, being hardened may be something that reflects on the people at that time. They were hardened. The water was hardened, so people, they had to build the pipes so they could take them apart because they were so calcium-rich that they would get clogged up, and they had to kind of build the pipes so they could pull them apart. So you can kind of see on the right-hand side here how they're in segments. You could find the clog by taking one segments apart and clean out the clog. Again, Colossae had very cold springs, and Hierapolis had hot springs. And also on the right, on the bottom right-hand side, which some of those in the back hand, so you see a cross coming out of a menorah. And again, the speculation is that it showed that people did understand that out of Christianity, out of the Jewish religion came Christianity, and they were very linked and they were tied close together. So that's the speculation on what that symbol means, why it was inscribed in one of the stones there. So I thought that's the seven churches. I thought I'd try to wrap this up by giving you some key takeaways or some thoughts that I came away with or realized more deeply or understood a little better. And one of them is found in Galatians 4:4, where it says, you know, in the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son. And so what does that really mean? I guess, you know, and we know that that means that at the right time, God knew when to send Jesus Christ. And why was it the right time? Well, it was because of the Pax Romana, which means the peace of Rome, a Roman peace. And it was just for a very short period of time that the Roman Empire was in a state where it was safe to travel. There was roads, there was reading and writing, there was a legal system. And it allowed for Christianity to spread. And if it was at any other different times, it would have been too dangerous, or the culture was not set up so that Christianity could spread. They actually had a lot of Jewish communities all throughout Asia Minor, which also helped Christianity to spread. So by seeing this, you realize that that very moment you know, was a perfect time for Christ to come. And then when you read Galatians 4:4, is the fullness of time. So at just the right time, God sent his son and allowed Christianity to take off, allowed to spread, allowed due to the peace that Rome had at that time. It didn't last forever, but for that time period, there was very few wars. It wasn't pirates. You know, before then or after then, there would have been difficulty in spreading the word of God. Another key takeaway is what I say is Ephesians 3:6. And this is where it says the mystery of Christ, and that is that the Gentiles should be fellow heirs of the same body and partakers of his promise in Christ through the gospel. And you realize that when you go there, but really you realize that the Jewish community at that time period, you know, was a very, they're the only way, or they're the only ones that had a relationship with God. And the Jewish community actually kept the Gentiles at a distance. They're very extreme Jewish community. The most devout Pharisees actually had a practice that even if a shadow of a Gentile was even came across you, that you were unclean. You had to go take a bath and become unclean. And that's how they viewed the Gentiles. And the Gentiles, many of them were God-fearing people. Actually, Acts 10 calls Cornelius God-fearing. But they were never allowed to go the full distance or come the whole way to have a relationship with the Jews. The Jews kicked them out. And up until that point, there was no way for them to really have a relationship with God in the sense that they were kept at a distance by the Jews. And you could convert to Judaism, but it was a very difficult process. Many God-fearing Gentiles chose not to do it because they're so difficult to convert. But now when Christ came, the mystery of Christ, and what Paul says all through Ephesians really is that the Gentiles now could become fellow heirs and be the same body, partakers of the same promise. And this was a massive mind shift. I think when we read this in the Bible today, we don't realize how difficult of a time it would have been to have Jewish converts that were now Christians looking at Gentiles as brothers. It was a huge mind shift because before then they were just at a distance. They weren't even allowed to associate with them. And we know that at different times, even Paul had to go to Peter and say, hey, you're not treating the Gentiles properly. And I think when we read this, we just realize we don't realize how much of this was a big mind shift in the minds of the Jewish Christians at that time, and how big a deal it was for the first time that Gentiles had a way to come to God and come to Christ and could be part of one body and fellow heirs, as it says. So seeing this, you know, going through those times, you kind of realize the times which they were living in and how big of a, I guess, change in mind and how they had to view the Gentiles was a big change in their culture. Another takeaway is, again, each one of the churches had a responsibility to overcome. And the word overcome comes from the word Nike, which means victory. So all seven churches have or if you want to say eras, as they're not churches, eras, had their time to overcome or be victorious. And when you're going through this, you see that all these cities now are destroyed or gone or in ruins, and they're not here anymore. But for that time period, whether you're part of Philadelphia or Laodicea or Ephesus, they all had their time period to overcome. And the takeaway is that we also have our time to overcome or be victorious. We have to overcome society, just like they did. They had huge pressures from society. They lived in a Roman culture, which practices all sorts of pagan worship. They had all sorts of different things that were going on in that society. Probably not much different from today. We don't have necessarily the worship of pagan gods, but we definitely worship many other things, you know, material things. We worship people's looks. We worship movie stars. So in many ways, they had the same things to overcome. They had to overcome Satan. Satan was a huge influence, just like he is today in today's society. But the attitude to Satan, the influence of Satan, and they actually had to overcome self. You know, unless all of us, you know, what society we live in today or back then, we have to overcome ourselves, our own human nature. So all of us have to overcome. And I had this little sign, little symbol there, Nike, the Nike sign, because it really means being victorious. And the only way we can be victorious isn't through our own efforts. You know, we can't work harder ourselves, but we have to rely, and through the power of Christ, we all need to overcome or have victory over society, Satan, and self, just like the seven churches all had to be victorious to receive the reward. So we see that the overcoming was a strong message in my mind at the feast. We went over every church, went to each church site, and each one had a message to overcome. So that's the end. I just want to leave you with a few photos, additional photographs of how it looked over in Turkey. And I do want to recommend that, again, if you ever have the opportunity to go to Turkey on your own, please do so. I think you'll find it very safe. This time it's very safe, enjoyable place to visit. Many Europeans go there to vacation. You can definitely see these sites if you want, or if a church ever does another tour like this, whether it's here or another one, if you have the opportunity and the ability to go, I'd highly recommend it, because there's very many, many benefits in seeing these ancient biblical sites and how it ties into the Bible and making the Bible much more clearer. And now when you read Ephesians and Galatians and some of those books, it makes things much clearer of the things that Paul and the other apostles were writing about at that time. So thank you.